potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new films Annabelle Comes Home, Yesterday, Murder Mystery, and a look back at the film Attack the Block. I'm also going to be talking about some news, the trailer park, and the home cinema roundup featuring us and Night of the Creeps. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can also find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. Or you can reach out to me on Twitter at twitter.com/kevincarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
There's only one piece of news that I really want to address, and that's something that has to do with a movie that I'm actually going to review this week, which is Murder Mystery. Now, if you don't know the history behind this movie, you got to understand what happened to Adam Sandler in his career. He started out on Saturday Night Live, and then he made a couple films as a younger man, stuff like Billy Madison and Happy Gilmore. Those were big hits. Also, stuff like Bulletproof that didn't do terribly well, but kind of established him as a leading guy in sort of a weird situation. And then he became a massive box office success in the 90s with movies like Big Daddy and The Water Boy, but also some of the stuff like The Wedding Singer that he did with Drew Barrymore. But then eventually he started making kind of stupid movies again. I mean, stuff like Jack and Jill and Grown Ups and That's My Boy. I mean, he had some really terrible movies, and he became box office poison. And then what he did is he moved to Netflix about 7 or 8 years ago and signed a big deal with them. I think he did like 6 movies with them, and then he re-upped in 2017, I believe. Now, one of the things that's happened over the years is critics have just learned to just hate him. Critics just cannot stand Adam Sandler, and it's a well-deserved thing. Apparently, he's a really nice guy, but in terms of his movie output, critics tend to hate his work. Well, when he got the job at Netflix and started making these movies, everyone just kind of wrote him off. Well, Netflix came out this week, a week or so after Murder Mystery was actually released on their service, and they came out with the announcement more than 30 million accounts watched this movie in the first 3 days. And that was immediately met by skepticism of the movie world because, of course, oh, who could like Adam Sandler stuff? Forgetting the fact that movies like the grown-up films tended to do kind of well. Then I started seeing all these think pieces over the week about how you can't really believe that number and how that number's probably fake. Part of it is Netflix does not report to Nielsen or anything like that. And this isn't like a studio release at the box office where it's reported in Variety and box office news. You don't get those numbers. I mean, Netflix is under no obligation to provide people with any sort of viewership information. It's a private company. Now, it's a publicly held company, so they can't outright lie. But a lot of people have said, hey, you know, have they fudged the numbers or whatever? And I mean, yeah, it even went as far as I saw a guy, you know, and I think this guy was meaning this tongue in cheek, but he was basically calling for a fact before somebody could say that they've watched it, they had to take a quiz to prove that they've watched the movie. And I'm like, are you serious? Nobody suggested that everybody who watched the Game of Thrones finale has to take a quiz. And like people were saying, well, you know, how many people did people actually watch it? It says 30 million accounts, but what does that mean? Does that mean that it propagates? Like, we have a Netflix account in my house, and my wife has a profile, and I have a profile, and all three of my kids have a profile. So there's 5 profiles on Netflix, and there's some people who are, I mean, advancing conspiracy theories that it then says, well, one account counts as 5 views because 5 different people are on that account. And I'm like, well, now you're just making stuff up. The reality is, I believe the numbers. And here's why. Netflix came out and said it was like 13 million or more that watched it in the States, and the other 17 were overseas. This is different than going to pay for the movies. This does not mean people plopped down $9 and watched an Adam Sandler movie. What this means is that people watched it because it was available on Netflix. A lot of people have this subscription for Netflix for various things. They want to binge watch television, or they want to catch old movies, or they want to catch stuff that they've missed in theaters. But there's a lot of people that will just look at whatever's on there because they don't want to go out of the house, they don't want to go to the theaters, or they just want to spend money. That's different than like Game of Thrones, where Game of Thrones, that season finale, you had to get HBO specifically. Even then, I do believe that there's a question about, you know, were these autoplays? Because a lot of times if you look at the trailer, it'll autoplay the movie. And they do pump that stuff to the top of the list. They try to get you to watch it. And if you finish a movie and you like fall asleep or you turn off the TV, but you don't turn off your device like a Roku player or something like that, it may roll into another film. But I think that that's in the minority. I think really, honestly, I believe the number that 13 million accounts watched it. Why? Because it was free. In essence, you're already paying for the Netflix subscription. I talked about this back when Bird Box made so much noise about how many people watched it. And I said, well, that's different than people walking and specifically walking out and going to a theater and then paying money admission per person to go see the movie. Once it gets a little bit of buzz, it'll get there, and you'll hear what I have to say about this movie, but I also think that this isn't the standard Adam Sandler fare. I think it helped having Jennifer Aniston in it, that people are like, oh, hey, I'll give it a shot. And supposedly Netflix only reports a view as if people watch 70% of the movie, but still, that's a good amount. I mean, there's probably people who didn't finish watching the season finale of Game of Thrones, but I don't hear anybody complaining about that because it's cool to like Game of Thrones. Listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That song means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first one is Charlie's Angels, which opens on November 15th.
Outstanding Angels.
You have a new client?
Who is she?
I'm the lead programmer on a product that can revolutionize the power industry, but there is a possibility it can be weaponized.
Elena, we need to go.
Who are you?
I'm Bosley.
Welcome to the Townsend Agency. We exist because traditional law enforcement can't keep up. Let's get the weapon before it becomes every bad guy's favorite new toy.
I'm fine with them doing Charlie's Angels. Actually, I think this looks kind of interesting. The biggest reason this find this interesting is Kristen Stewart looks like she's actually acting. And it's weird to say that for just a stupid action pick, which is what this is. But it looks like she's getting rid of some of her Tourette syndrome tics that she has in there, which all that stuff that she does to fill the air between lines that you saw really happen in the Twilight movies. And I mentioned this when we were talking about the Robert Pattinson news about him becoming Batman. And I said, look, you can't do crap performances in five movies and not have that brought up to you for years to come. It'd be one thing if it was one movie, but this was like an entire series of movies. And same thing with Kristen Stewart. I don't care how many prestigious acting awards she gets, she still has to prove herself as an actress, and she sucked so hard in the Twilight movies that it's interesting to see her act. So this looks good. I don't care if Elizabeth Banks is in it. I don't care if she's playing Bosley and Bosley's a girl. I just get the feeling this trailer looks a little bit TV-ish, and I know it's a TV series that's made into a movie, but it looks like something like a Whiskey Cavalier pilot more than a feature-length motion picture. But I'm curious to see it. I'm curious to see Elizabeth Banks. I think she's got talent, and I'd like to see her do something more than what she's done. I want to see her direct more, and so I'm looking forward to this. The next one I want to hit really quick is Midway, which opens on November 8th.
Pearl Harbor is the greatest intelligence failure in American history.
Present! Fire!
The Japanese are planning something bigger.
So what's the target?
We believe it's Midway.
Washington disagrees.
Washington is wrong.
This is, of course, a war film. It's directed by Roland Emmerich, which I tend to like his stuff. I think he does spectacle well. I don't want to see another Shakespeare movie by him, but I think he does spectacle well. And this one looks like it could be pretty good. It looks like it might be a little bit too much CGI enhanced. And I think it's going to have a lot to overcome with comparisons to Dunkirk because of the fighter planes and everything like that. And Dunkirk looks so good, even though there was a crap story in that movie. I'm looking forward to this one. This looks like it might be a nice, hefty award film contender in the end of the year. That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I will review Murder Mystery and Annabelle Come Home. back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the movie reviews with Murder Mystery, since I talked about that in the previous segment. A married couple on a European vacation are caught up in the middle of a multiple murder of wealthy elites.
Charles is inviting us to spend the weekend with him on a yacht.
There's been a murder!
Should we pull it out?
No, it's a foot long knife.
Husband, he's a detective.
I'll put it back. Don't put it back.
Did you notice anything out of the ordinary?
The Americans.
But we didn't do this.
Someone's trying to frame us.
It's just like death in the library.
What happens in death in a library?
They died. That's why it's called death in the library.
First of all, this isn't a typical Adam Sandler movie. It doesn't have the obnoxious, crass, overly stupid element to it. If you want to talk about stuff like the Billy Madison, the dunderhead, the really stupid guy, or like the gimmicky stuff like Jack and Jill. And it doesn't feel like it's populated by a bunch of his friends like David Spade and Chris Rock and Shaquille O'Neal and people like that, or Kevin James. It's kind of a straightforward movie. It's written by the guy who wrote Zodiac, by the way. So the guy actually has some talent writing it, and it looks really good. It's shot very well. It does fall into the category of Adam Sandler doing a movie where he and his friends can go have a vacation, go shoot a movie by doing it in a beautiful location, because they're like in Monte Carlo. And the movie itself, I'm really on the fence with it, because there's elements of it. There are funny moments to it. And it's also not completely on Adam Sandler's shoulder. He's kind of, even though he's a main character, he's really kind of side character. And Jennifer Aniston and he share a lot, which makes it interesting. So I wouldn't say it's either one of their movies. It's kind of both of theirs, and they work well together. I'm not a huge fan of Jennifer Aniston, but I thought she did a fine job in the movie. The comedy does, especially at the beginning, fall into that stammering, hemming, and hawing, awkward comedy that you see in like a Judd Apatow movie. I don't particularly like that. I do think it's interesting watching Sandler do it, because that's usually not his shtick. The rest of the cast, once you bring in all the other people, like you got Luke Evans as this wealthy, beautiful looking socialite in Europe who brings them along for the ride. And then you've got Gemma Arterton in there as an actress. And I'm a huge Gemma Arterton fan, by the way. I think she's gorgeous. I will watch anything she's in, just because it's always nice to see her, even if it's a terrible movie. So I have a real thing for Gemma Arterton in this one. And she looks great in it. So it's fun watching her. It's an okay mystery. I would put this on the level of, you know, something like a Murder, She Wrote movie. I mean, it's not Jessica Fletcher going to a dinner party and somebody getting killed, but it does kind of feel like it's cut from that cloth. It feels like it's this very contrived murder mystery. The characters aren't as fleshed out as they could be. They sometimes do silly things. Part of it is Jennifer Aniston's character reads all these murder mysteries, so she comes with a knowledge, and Adam Sandler's character's trying to become a detective in New York City, so he's looking at his more pragmatic detective, because at one point she says the most obvious person isn't the murderer, and he's like, no, it usually is the most obvious person. He's coming at it from a pragmatic view. She's coming at it from a written novel view. It's not a great movie, but it does have some laughs. And it's different than some of the other stuff Sandler's done. So it doesn't hit that lowbrow level that he's usually aiming for. But yeah, I mean, you're talking about something like a lesser Pink Panther movie or a throwaway Murder, She Wrote episode. It's not terribly well written. But it's passable for 90 minutes if you just kind of want to watch it. My wife liked it. I mean, she likes that kind of just throwaway comedies. It almost feels like a TV movie, although it does have a little bit bigger of a budget and, you know, some nicer locations. I'm right on the fence. I'm actually going to be really nice, because I have some respect for how they did this and what they did and how people are working a little bit outside of their box. So I'm going to have to say, I'm going to give it a kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Annabelle Comes Home. In this third film in the saga of the demonic doll, the Warren's babysitter accidentally unleashes Annabelle from her safe space.
Everything you see in here is either haunted, cursed, or has been used in some kind of ritualistic practice.
Don't your parents keep any creepy stuff around?
We keep it all locked away in a room so that we're safe. It's not really good for anyone to go in there. what you do. I let her out.
Who? Annabelle. I'm sorry. What else did you touch?
I respect the heck out of the Conjuring series. Part of the reason is because James Wan, with both the Conjuring and the Insidious movies, but even more with the Conjuring and Insidious came out at a time where found footage was king. Every horror movie was found footage. And I hate found footage. I'm not going to go into why. Go back and listen to some old episodes of Fat Guys at the Movies and you'll hear me rant about what I hate about found footage. And he made these movies that were atmospheric and scary and cinematic at a time when that was not chic. And he said, the heck with you found footage, I'm going to do something different. And he made a cottage industry for himself. Now, there have been two actual Conjuring movies. And then this is the third Annabelle movie. And I guess they have the Nun. Is the Nun? I can't remember whether the Nun's Insidious or Conjuring. I think it might be. These kind of run together. But this is like, what, the fifth or sixth movie in the Conjuring universe. This one actually has the Warrens in it. In the other Annabelle movies, they kind of swerved in and out of the plot. But this one has, Vera Farmiga and Patrick Wilson playing the Warrens. They come in right at the beginning, and the whole thing is them putting this doll. It shows how they get the doll and how they put the doll away. And then when their daughter is left home with a babysitter over the weekend, it's not the babysitter who lets it out. It's a friend of hers who comes in and meddles around into the demon room, which, and never go in that room if you ever have access to the Warren's house. I mean, Lorraine Warren just recently died. So I don't know who ended up with all this stuff, which kind of, that's kind of a freaky thought on its own. But the movie itself isn't terribly complex. There's not a whole lot of depth to it. There's not a whole lot of character development. There's not a whole lot of plotting in here. But I will say this. It's immaculately made. It is something that gets set up. There's the line that if you're going to put a gun on the wall in act one, you better use it by act two. They put a lot of guns on the wall in this movie and they set this thing up. And then with the turn of the key, everything kind of starts to come unwound. And then it just becomes an exercise in atmosphere and suspense and scares, and a lot of them jump scares, you know, let's be fair. There's probably more CGI in it than there needs to be in terms of literal smoke. But I will say it's exceptionally well done as an exercise in suspense. And it's essentially just a little haunted house movie about these girls trying to survive the night with a demonic doll that's been unleashed. Now, there's a couple moments that are a little bit too on the nose, or they're maybe going a little bit too far, but they do use certain elements of practical effects, which I appreciate, which I always loved about the Conjuring movies. And it's an effective little film. Like I said, it's not going to change anything, but it's creepy and it's effective and it's atmospheric. And again, it's something that isn't relying on extreme violence or extreme torture or just grief. It's showing good old fashioned haunted house type stuff that I think has always worked and still works today. So I'm going to give this one totally rocks, simply for what it was doing in its simplistic sense.
It rocks.
Excellent.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Yesterday and Attack the Block.
Yesterday, all my troubles seem so far away. Now it looks as though they're here to stay.
And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews and talk about Yesterday. Danny Boyle directs this film about a struggling singer-songwriter who mysteriously becomes the only person in the world that remembers the Beatles, so he starts to release their music as his own.
When did you write that?
I didn't write it. Paul McCartney wrote it. The Beatles.
Who?
Do you genuinely not know who the Beatles are?
Genuinely?
Then I'm in a really, really, really complicated situation.
Hi, we should talk. See, we pay and you write songs and then you make a ton of money. And then we take most of it.
Hey Jude.
I've been waiting half my life for you to wake up and love me. But I'm a school teacher and you are the world's greatest singer-songwriter.
I'm not.
Except for you are.
The first thing I got to talk about is it's a Danny Boyle movie. I love Danny Boyle. He's one of my favorite directors. He's up there with Wes Anderson and the Coen brothers. He does brilliant movies. even his movies that aren't great are absolutely engaging and well-made. And that's not even talking about his fantastic movies. I mean, he's the guy who did Slumdog Millionaire. He did the original Trainspotting. He did Millions. He did 28 Days Later. He was going to do a James Bond movie, but he ended up quitting it because I think he was shackled too much, because he is a very out-of-the-box guy. He does some really amazing stuff, and it was probably good that I would have loved to have seen a Danny Boyle James Bond movie, but it was probably a good idea that they parted ways, because it was sort of like Edgar Wright wanting to do Ant-Man his own way, but not the way Marvel Studios wanted him to do it. And I think Eon Productions has a certain way they wanted the James Bond movie to go, and also I don't think he had control over the cast that he wanted. I think he probably demands a more intimate approach. So Danny Boyle is a fantastic director, and in his hands, he really gives this energy and fun, and it pops. And there's something about having Danny Boyle involved in it that under somebody else's hand, it would have been drab and boring. But even the stuff, I'm not a huge Beatles fan. I mean, I recognize they got some great stuff, but I'm not a huge, you know, they say in the movie Pulp Fiction, you're either an Elvis man or a Beatles man. I'm an Elvis man. My son's a Beatles man. But I think you can come to this, and at least if you like some of the Beatles songs and recognize that their quality and the sort of the genius, the musical genius behind it, you can still enjoy this movie. Now, what's interesting is we've had a couple 1-2 punches of musical movies. You had Bohemian Rhapsody last year, and you had Rocket Man earlier this spring, and those were both essentially biopics, but they were about the music almost a little bit more than they were about the artist. And so it was a different way to approach a biopic of an artist. This is 100% going after homage to the music itself. This is about the music. It's not necessarily about George, Paul, John, and Ringo. Even though, of course, they're integral to the background of this movie. And it's just a charming movie, and it reminds you of how good some of the music is. Himesh Patel, who plays the main character, he's fantastic in it as the struggling singer. And one of the things that he does that is incredibly well done in an acting perspective is he shows the agony and the guilt he feels claiming this is his own work. There's multiple points where people call him a genius or marvel at how he can do this. And you could tell he feels guilty for doing it, but at the same time, he can't stop. And then there's also becomes a question of if you were in this situation, and you know, it's a Twilight Zone thing. You don't know if it's going to turn back or end. Do you owe it to them to give credit, or do you owe it to the music to get it out there? And of course, he makes himself look more like a genius because he has the entire Beatles catalog and he's cranking it out in just a couple months. Whereas even the Beatles, they took decades to do this and they had different phases. You know, you look at the stuff from Hard Day's Night, it's quite different than Yellow Submarine. And that's what's so amazing about this movie is they're able to use that nuance. Now, there's some problems with it. One of the problems I have, Kate McKinnon's in it. She plays a record executive, and you hear her in the trailer. My problem is that I realize this when I watch this movie, is Kate McKinnon's not a very good actor. She's a very funny actor, and she does sketch comedy extremely well. That's why she's been very good for Saturday Night Live. But all of the times I've seen her in any movie, I've seen her, and she feels like she's just coming off as Kate McKinnon from Saturday Night Live. She's kind of just got this goofy smile that says her thing and gets it over, and it sounds like every character she plays. I just did not like her in this movie at all. I found her very ungenuine. And I know that puts me in the minority because Kate McKinnon's so many people's spirit animal, but I didn't like her. The other problem is, and I'm harping on the women in this movie, and I blame both Richard Curtis, who wrote this, and Danny Boyle a little bit. Lily James plays the love interest. And the thing I didn't like about her was it's the same reason why when I was a kid growing up, I always, as a young boy, I didn't like love interests in movies. Not because I was bored of seeing a girl, but because I was annoyed when they just had somebody who was just like, ha ha, I love you. And there was no depth to them. They were just there as someone to save or someone to help. That's one of the things I always liked about Star Wars, is there was something more to Princess Leia than just the girl in distress. there's no real depth to Lily James's character. And maybe part of that's just because she's a beautiful girl and she's adorable and sweet looking. And she's just, you know, you just want to give her a big hug when you see her on screen. But I realize all the movies I've seen her in, when she kind of plays this flirty, flibberty gibbet character, you know, same thing when she was in that Mamma Mia sequel. I thought she was terrible in that. Because there's no depth. It's just, she's like, I'm pretty and ha ha ha, and I look cute. And, you know, I just didn't feel like there's any weight to her character. She was just the pretty girl he never had sex with earlier in his life. And that, to me, was a down part in this movie. I liked the struggle he went through with the, what to do with the music more than what to do with the girl. But still, it's a charming little movie, and it's a wonderful film, and a unique way to honor the music of a band that isn't doing this obviously anymore, because two of the people are dead. So I'm gonna have to say that Yesterday rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Attack the Block. I'm doing a retro review here. As I mentioned last week, I'd done a movie marathon with my kids. I showed them a bunch of sci-fi movies, and so I'm talking about these because I think this has a little bit of connective tissue with something like Night of the Creeps, which I'm going to be talking about later. And so I decided to resurrect this. I've never talked about this one specifically on the show because I never saw it in its initial release, but I figured it was worth checking out and talking about now. Joe Cornish directs this action comedy about a group of teens in a rough London neighborhood who try to thwart an alien invasion.
What is that car?
That's an alien, bruv. Believe it. And I landed in the wrong place, though. You get me?
Well done, lads. He discovered a species hitherto unknown to science.
Believe.
Maybe there was a party at the zoo.
Yo, check it.
More what?
Them tings.
Lovely fireworks.
Mom, it's an alien invasion.
Of course it is.
I'm killing them straight. Let's get tooled up, blood.
I remember when this hit South by Southwest. What was it, in like 2011? And it just made all this splash and all this noise, and everyone loved it, and it was the greatest movie ever, and oh, go see it. And then it came out in theaters and it flopped. Nobody saw it. Part of it is because these kids speak in such thick, street London accents that it's kind of hard to understand what they say. And it's on DVDs, you can turn, or Blu-rays, you can turn on the subtitles. It's not something that's going to connect necessarily with an American audience, because it's very much a London movie. It's about London. It's about the kids in London. It's about the projects in London. It's about the people who live in London and how they feel surrounded by, you know, one of the biggest cities in the world. Sort of like doing a movie about Brooklyn. It's got a lot of character to it. But, you know, if you've never been to Brooklyn, you've not lived or spent any time in Brooklyn, you lose a little bit of that. But still, it's a fun movie. It's the movie that gave John Boyega his start before he got in Star Wars. And it also has Jodie Whittaker, the current Doctor Who. And it's, you know, it's a fun movie. It's a very energetic movie. It's about these monsters that these street kids are trying to protect their homes from, their apartment complex from, these insane monsters that are running around the streets of London. It's very witty. It throws a lot at you at once. Like I said, get it on DVD or Blu-ray, but put on the subtitles, because you're probably going to need them to understand everything they say, because they just go at you whip fast. So it's definitely a movie, if you've missed it, or if you watched it back in 2011 when it came out and you haven't seen it in a while, revisit it, because it's a lot of fun. Attack the Block is a great little modern alien invasion piece. I'm going to have to say it totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about the box office and the home cinema roundup featuring Us and Night of the Creeps. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's finish up the show with the box office. And it's interesting to talk about the box office right now because we are about halfway through the summer. It's a great way to look in and see how the summer's been going. And there have been some very noticeable, I wouldn't say flops. I mean, there have been some flops. Let's not mince words. I mean, there are movies that did not do terribly well. But there have been a lot of movies, not just in the summer, but even in the spring, that have, we'll say, underperformed. And a lot of them happen to be sequels. I mean, obviously stuff like Men in Black International, that underperformed. A Secret Life of Pets 2 as well. The only thing that's going to save that movie is they actually kept the production costs down. It was less than $100 million to make. And Godzilla, King of the Monsters, it's doing well. It's over $100 million, but it's still not making a huge splash. It's not making even as much money, I think, as the last one did. Dark Phoenix, huge flop. That movie's, I think it's about $60 million. It's not even going to finish off the year with more than $75 million or so domestically for a massive thing. Shaft is a remake, or Child's Play underperformed. There's a whole bunch of them. Now, in the midst of these that are big underperformers, you've had some that have done well. Stuff like Ma, which has done exceptionally well. It's a Blumhouse movie. They make them on the cheap, and it's made over $40 million. It's more than doubled and tripled and quadrupled its budget. And Aladdin tended to do well. It's got some legs to it. John Wick Chapter 3 did exceptionally well. Now, what's interesting is a lot of people are talking about that summer slump and the sequelitis. Now, last week, Toy Story 4, people were saying it's going to cure box office tumble. It's going to make $150, maybe even $160 million. And it didn't. It made $121 million. Just under that over the weekend. Now, first of all, that's the best that any Toy Story movie has done. Even Toy Story 3 came in under that in terms of its opening weekend. That's a phenomenal number, but it's not at the level that Incredibles 2 or Finding Dory were. And people are saying, is it still the sequelitis? Here's what's going on. It has nothing to do with sequels per se, because the biggest movie of the year, Avengers Endgame, is a sequel. And it made oodles of money. It overperformed. Here's the thing. Is this a sequel that people have asked for and wanted? I wouldn't say that about any. I don't think anyone asked for or wanted a Child's Play sequel or even a Toy Story 4 as well as it's done. Men in Black International, Secret Life of Pets. You know, I know people wanted a John Wick sequel. I know people wanted an Avengers sequel. That's, I think, how we have to look at these movies. No one wanted a Shaft reboot 19 years after the last Shaft reboot. So the numbers are soft, but the numbers are soft not because people are tired of sequels or remakes. It's just because, I mean, heck, Aladdin's doing well. And The Lion King's, I think, going to kill this summer. I think what it is, it's that Hollywood needs to make movies that people want to see. And they don't always do that. And even though Toy Story rocked the world with $121 million last weekend, Child's Play came in with like $14 million. It just barely went over its budget. And then Anna just barely made it into the top 10. So it's more about you need to make movies people want to see. And when you make movies people want to see, they go see them. And if there's something unique or different like Ma or even like Booksmart that's doing well in its very limited markets or Rocket Man, which is a big crowd pleaser, those are the movies that are going to get traction and make the money. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. The first one is Us, which actually came out last week on disc, but it's worth talking about again. Jordan Peele directs this unnerving thriller about a family on vacation who are confronted by their violent doppelgangers.
What are you people?
It's us.
They look exactly like us. They think like us. They know where we are. We need to move and keep moving. They won't stop until they kill us. Or we kill them.
I revisited this movie this past week, and it is an exceptionally well-made film. I will go as far to say it's one of my favorites of the year so far. And I didn't think that when I first saw it because it was relatively, you know, it was March when it came out. But I look back on it and I go, no, this is an incredibly well-constructed, creepy movie. Now, at times he does over-explain without explaining. But it's paced very well. It's got some really creepy scenes and moments, but it doesn't feel like it's abusive or problematic. The Blu-ray comes with some nice special features. It has a behind the scenes, a bunch of behind the scenes stuff and deleted scenes. And in those Peele does explain a little bit about what he was trying to do. You know, so what some of the imagery was, like the hands across America and what the us people represent. He didn't do that too much when the movie was in release, and I liked that because I wanted this to be a conversation starter. Us is different than Get Out in the sense that Get Out, the social commentary was right there on the surface. You did not have to think very hard to uncover and dissect the social commentary in that film. Us is a little more complex. Us is a little harder to deconstruct. And I want you to think about it. I want people to watch it and think about it and discuss it before they start listening to what Jordan Peele says he was trying to do, because I think it has a lot to say, even if it has something to say that Jordan Peele didn't necessarily put in there. That's the beautiful thing about art, is sometimes things get revealed that the artist didn't necessarily even put in. Sometimes it shows up unconsciously, or it's something that they just made the world the way the world works, and it reveals a truth that they didn't necessarily try to do. So I'm going to have to say, Us totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
Next one I want to talk about really quickly is Night of the Creeps. Shout Factory, one of my favorite studios nowadays, distributors. I guess it's a studio. They do movies. But most of the stuff that they're known for is redistributing old films and some of their new stuff. They have a whole bunch of these fun cult films that are sci-fi, horror, action. And Night of the Creeps is a great one. It stars one of my favorite actors of all time, Tom Atkins. Because Tom Atkins, no matter what movie he is in, he could be in a Star Wars movie and you'd still have him walk on screen and you'd think he smells immediately of stale cigarettes and Miller Lite. And he plays that character perfectly in this movie. And what Shout Factory has done is they've brought together the Collector's Edition, which is a 2-disc Blu-ray set that includes the theatrical release and the director's cut, which there's a slight difference near the ending of the director's cut, which used to, I think, exist as just an alternate ending on the original DVD and Blu-ray, but you can watch the full movie with it embedded in there. It's a piece to watch. But really, let's talk quickly about the movie. This mid-80s horror flick sees an invasion of body-controlling slugs from outer space attack a small college town.
The night of the fall is finally here. It's going to be the best night of their lives. But tonight is also the night of the creeps.
They get in through your mouth and you walk around while they incubate, even if you're dead.
Zombies, exploding heads, creepy crawlies.
Oh, I got good news and bad news, girls.
What?
The good news is your dates are here.
What's the bad news?
They're dead.
This is sort of like a mixture of Slither, Invasion of the Body Snatchers, and Revenge of the Nerds. And it's very funny to watch now because we're about 30 years after it was made, and it takes place in the 80s, which is contemporary to when it was made, and it flashes back to the 50s, which is 30 years before that. So it has this nice little time stepping stone that we have. A cast of a lot of people you don't see all that often, but they do a good job for what they are, and sort of this Revenge of the Nerds setup with these dorky guys that like the sorority girl who's and then they have a feud with the Beta House. Now the special features on this one, it has all the special features from the theatrical version that came out before, which is a 5-part documentary on making the film with everybody from the director Fred Decker to, you know, the special effects and makeup people. It talks about Tom Atkins, one of my favorite actors in movies. Also, it has deleted scenes and the theatrical trailer. That's on the first disc. The second disc has a whole bunch of new stuff. It's got the audio commentary by just the director, but it also has the actors doing an audio commentary. And it has like, oh gosh, something like 7 or 8 of these new special features that Shout Factory has been cranking out for their discs. It goes back to their locations and it talks to the different actors and it has an interview with the editor. So it has a nice little selection of special features that are worth getting. Even if you own a copy of Night of the Creeps, worth getting this as the collector's edition because it has a bunch of special features that you won't have to worry about them disappearing off of a rental on the cloud somewhere. So I'm going to have to say Night of the Creeps, fun little throwback 80s movie, totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
And that is it for this week. I need to go. When I come back next week for the 4th of July holiday, I'm going to be talking about Spider-Man Far From Home and Midsommar. And until then, have a fat time at the movies.